onto stuff. And thank you so much, Adam.
All right. Yeah, you too. Of course. Anytime for your records. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Special thanks to our amazing guest, Fury, and to Prison Pipeline Collective member, Karen James, for post-production. Free them all.
Sorry, I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late, everything here is great, but we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills. Some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory, not because it's a must. But it's because this is the only place where you're hearing the right stuff. You're hearing the truth, you're hearing the good sound, and you're digging people who knows what it's all about. So pick up on a few things and lay down some of them other things and just dig KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And remember, I said so. I, Screaming Jay Hawkins, I ain't walking, I'm talking. I'm squawking. Become a member now. Become a member of KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm about to sign off. Bye, 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 bye.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
It's a piece of history, and I know a lot of people are talking about it, and I feel like I've just seen people write books on them, like they weren't even there, you know? I was definitely there. This is a part of my life, and I know there were some other people that this was really a lot for. I'm glad that I was a part of it and I felt like we needed to do that. The struggle continues.
Welcome to Nothing is Final Part 1, Episode 13 of It Did Happen Here. I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores. Last episode, you heard about the final years of the Coalition for Human Dignity. Now we'll hear from the punks.
We started with China. In the 80s, China was a black punk rocker, a fierce young street fighter, and anti-racist activist. China survived that and built a life for herself in defiance of the targeting she endured in her youth.
The city of Portland grew and changed as well. In 1990, the median home price in Portland was around $80,000. In the year 2000, it more than doubled to $166,000.
Now in 2021, it's at $500,000.
As an effect of this gentrification, by 2010, there were no majority black neighborhoods in the city. The former Industrial Northwest District, just north of downtown, transformed overnight into the condo-laden Pearl District. Crime was down, property prices were up, and the realtors and real estate developers were drunk on prosperity.
The notorious Pine Street Theater, the site of much conflict with the Boneheads, and host of dangerous and exciting shows by Northwest hardcore bands like The Accused and Poison Idea, was rebranded in 1992 as La Luna. La Luna closed in 1999. Starry Night flipped ownership and became the Roseland. Satyricon officially closed down in 2003.
What happened to the punks in this rapidly gentrifying city? For most of them, it was pretty good for a while. There were new places to get burritos and pizza, new record stores. Basements of rental houses became venues for touring regional and national punk bands, so lots of punks quit hanging out downtown. Hundreds of young people moved to the medium-sized city to launch bands or make art or just party in the local punk scene. There were lots of group houses and interesting projects. Jobs were scarce, but rent was cheap, for a while. Anti-racist action had been a vital force to galvanize the punks in the fight against racism and fascism. Conditions were prime for anti-racist organizing, but by 1992, the local ARA chapter was on its last legs. Why? Here's Jason.
The ARA scenario lasted intensely for 2 years. The national meeting was in Portland in 89 and in 90. And we tried to do more in 91, and it was just proving really, really difficult. It was hard to get people more involved. I think, one, because we had already made such stride, it wasn't life or death. People felt like they could sit back a little bit, and they did. ARA nationally totally got hijacked in 91, 92 by the Trotskys. They tried to hijack it from us in 91. They came and with a big contingent and tried to get us to vote to ratify all these things. And we were like, this isn't us. We're not a left-wing political organization. We're anti-racist activists. We're not just looking at the tips of our noses either. We see a bigger picture, and so we're willing to work with you people, but you're not going to come in and take over our meetings, and you're not going to take over our structure. And they did that in many places.
Without the immediate threat of skinhead violence, and also distrustful of the organized left, the punks turned inwards.
Most of the punks had walked away from it. I mean, they were still there, and there was still really, really political shows going on. Resist was huge. Deprived was great. They were still killing it, doing a lot of stuff. Deprived became Defiance. They never stopped doing what they were doing. It was through music instead of through this political apparatus.
Kelly Halliburton was a member of three of the bands Jason just mentioned: Resist, Defiance, and Deprived.
It wasn't just laziness or selling out on our part. There were some issues with the activist groups that we didn't completely align with ideologically. We were more focused on the musical part of things, and that was important in its own way, too. Our hearts were in the right place, and we were definitely, I think we were part of a culture that made Portland the way it is now, for better or worse. A lot of that came, I feel like, as a direct result of some of the things that my culture was pushing for back then. These are things that matter: anti-racism, this feeling that other life forms can feel pain and fear, and maybe you should think about that when you make your dietary or fashion choices, or the homophobia that we've been raised to accept our whole lives. There weren't a lot of other people at that time outside of our culture, it seemed, that were really thinking along those same lines. And I know there were other groups. We didn't know the older activists. We were young. We were punk rockers. We were finding our voices. At that magic point in the late 80s, we found each other. We found some strength in that and some unity, and it was really great.
Anti-racist skinhead Pete Little continued working with various political groups.
It's important to acknowledge that in a lot of the folks who came out of ARA and into and out of Sharp and into the anti-racist skinhead scene, there was also, I remember there being some sentiment of folks feeling wary and suspicious of the left and feeling like oftentimes like they had been utilized when needed. The movement that had sustained ARA and Sharp and the other, what I think of as militant but subcultural elements, the movement wasn't there in the same way. You didn't have CHD, you didn't have ARA, you didn't have the kind of organizational and broader social movement context that made militants of the previous generation more survivable. And in some ways, I think building countercultures is valuable because it's a home for kids from the island of the misfit toys, right? And it also can be a culture that offers different values than the dominant culture. Hopefully, those subcultures embrace values that lead towards freedom and that they combat some of the more destructive elements of mass culture. But I think as well, within the remnants of the subculture where there was a lot of infighting and a lot of the same like violent energy that had been directed in a unified way against the boneheads became directed inward in ways that were tragic and self-destructive.
Subcultures were grappling with their own participation in forms of oppression as they attempted to fight against it in the community. Interpersonal violence, addiction, misogyny, homophobia, many who were active in this era were on a spectrum of understanding their place in the oppression, including just being oppressive. The destructive and self-destructive actions of the Sharps repelled a lot of people. Here's Sharp member Michael Clark.
The daily involvement, for me, dissipated the bigger my drug and alcohol problem got. I got a little too messed up behind some drugs and some booze to hang on to my altruistic good guy persona, and I went pretty south pretty fast. I had some differences of opinion, and I'm not going to go into how gangs or crews are run, but there's definitely a lot of politics, and sometimes things don't quite go your way, and we had some issues around someone beating a woman that I didn't really like, and I had a little too much booze, and I couldn't really let it go, and I kind of got a little busy with it, so kind of went against the grain of following directions, which is something I've always been pretty good at. Long story short, in that kind of environment, I disrespected people. That was pretty much the beginning of the end for me. I was getting really into cocaine and heroin and methamphetamines and drinking a fifth or a half gallon a day to take the edge off. My nickname was Psycho, so I was really known for getting really intoxicated and starting fights we didn't need to be in. You know, I got beyond my there's a time for that kind of thing and just pretty much wanted to kill everybody everywhere I went. That's a lot of energy for a crew to deal with. To be handling every fight you get yourself into, every crew that you start a fight with that we're supposed to be affiliated with, it gets to be a lot. So I had to go, which was reasonable. Broke my heart at the time. I went down the toilet pretty bad. 5/17/06 was the day I walked out of a detox center, and I've been sober ever since. Pretty much have a commitment to nonviolence. And for me, violence and ego was a lifestyle that served me, like kind of like a broken tool. It did a lot of good, but like most things, I kind of ended up abusing it. That part of me is so linked to drugs and alcohol now that I really have to have a commitment to not be violent. And one thing that really helped, in 07, I got custody of my 6-year-old daughter. So I became a single parent. of a beautiful little girl. And for the first time in my life, I was the responsible adult around, which was pretty funny because I was 34. That really helped in that commitment to nonviolence. You know, I don't miss waking up in jail and going, I mean, every time I woke up in jail, I'd think to myself, oh God, what am I doing here with all these losers? You know, you know? And I was always in jail for fighting because I never knew when to quit. Haven't had to go to jail. And life looks a lot different today.
The rest of the episode is from It Did Happen Here, Nothing is Final, where Scott Nakagawa and Eric Ward talked together at an event sponsored by the Multnomah County Library.
You know, I was on the board of the Coalition for Human Dignity for just a few years. I was down in Eugene, Oregon, and with help from Coalition for Human Dignity, before I was on the board, founded with others down there a group called Communities Against Hate. We saw ourselves as a sister organization to the Coalition for Human Dignity. It's interesting to think about those moments of success, right? It was the boring work that no one wants to talk about, right? You remember the phone calls, and sometimes you had to just write people a letter. I think about the boring work was also the most powerful. Public events we would do, right? We were mostly subculture kids, not all, but these events would pull in folks across the community. There was real power in the diversity of that community. And that's something, you know, we try to hold to now at Western State Center. As you know, this is not about a purity moment. What I mean by that is recognizing our humanity, that this is an issue of governance right now. Governance is fundamentally about who we consider to be human beings in a society. That's the next lesson. Besides the need to kind of be diverse in who you talk to and who you try to organize, right? Recognizing people's fundamental humanity. And that's what we were pushing for when we were kids in those punk rock clubs and hanging out, drinking our coffee, trying to figure out how we were going to eat. One of the lessons we still wrestle with is the fact that be wary of those who say they have the plan. The truth is, in that moment, most of us, you can tell me if I'm wrong, Scott, I don't think we had plans. Things worked out. And they primarily, things worked out when we were expansive, right? When we were generous, when we were outward facing, those things seemed to work out really well. When we would turn inward, we would get paranoid, we'd get cut off from the community. Our understanding of things would get distorted. I've heard from folks, activists in the 60s and 70s who have shared some of that same story. But I'm curious from your perspective, what are lessons that are valid to this moment? And how did we survive that moment? Did we have a plan? And if we didn't have a plan, how did things still work out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, history, in a kind of odd little way, you know, that we are created by the context that we're in. And sometimes organically, you're just in the right place at the right time and have the right disposition to respond in a way that history requires you to. That's often not something you plan for, as you put it, you know, not something that you're fully conscious of. And as you go through it, history teaches you to do next. And so, you know, I think there's some of that involved in it. It's a kind of iterative way of feeling your way forward through a situation that just requires you to constantly be responding. But I can name like any number of ridiculous, terrible mistakes and moments when, at least I can say, I misjudged the moment or misjudged the people I was among in ways that were just, you know, anything from dangerous to just outright silly. And so, you know, there's also that, and we rarely tell those stories when we talk about, you know, our personal histories. Because of course, we all want to remember the good stuff. It's how you comfort yourself as you move forward, that, you know, you remind yourself that you're capable, that you can. It's what gives you the confidence to keep taking the risk. But I'm not sure exactly about that, but I can tell you this. At the beginning of that process, I was mostly angry. You know, I was angry about the racism with which I was treated. I was shocked at the racism I encountered when I moved from Hawaii, which is a multiracial context, to Portland, Oregon, which was whitey, white, white back then. And, where that white hegemony was so overwhelming. You know, one of the ways that I understand these white rightists, the white nationalists, the Proud Boys and whatnot, one of the ways that I can get a little bit inside of their heads is that when I got to Portland, a white hegemony ruled in a way that was just amazing. It was the hegemony of white liberalism, one that saw no color, that did not understand race. And people of color lived under that kind of liberal tyranny of a huge white majority that believed itself to be actually progressive and inclusive when it was anything but. Right, so this is not about the virtue of the people. It was just about the reality of the structural relations that people were in at the time. And that is exactly the kind of thing that white conservatives are responding to, right? If you live in Portland, every single political elected office is blue. There's an overwhelming liberal majority. If you're a white conservative male in that context who identifies with the Republican Party, well, for one thing, all of the Republicans who want real power become Democrats, because they can't win political office. And the ones that are left do the kinds of things that the Multnomah County Republican Party has done, like voting to use 3%ers and Oath Keepers, two white nationalist groups, as event security to protect them from the Antifa. And so that becomes one of the ways you start to interpret and understand your position in the world, is as a victim in that way. And you might not even have anybody to vote on in election in your district, in your legislative district. Statewide, that's true of people who live in rural Oregon, where it's very, very red, but where we still maintain a majority of Democrats in the state legislature. So the power that you may have in terms of where you can make decisions that are in keeping with your values end at the level of the county, which of course feeds that posse comitatus power of the county, you know, like Bundy Bunch ideology that has people rejecting federal authority. So, that's kind of the situation. And so I started out just being kind of angry about the racism that I experienced, and then started to recognize over time that there was another thing at stake, which is that racism is a powerful anti-democratic ideology. It is the thing that divides us from our ability to invest in a robust safety net, in a robust wealth and equitable welfare state, the effects of which then, the austerity that drives, then creating more and more of the conditions that people interpret through the lens of race that causes us to then disinvest more and more and more, and then to start to see each other as rivals in competition with one another in a way that then further invigorates that process. So that's something that I learned through this process about the impact that can have, and why even in a state as white as Oregon, with a relatively small number of people of color in it, that what happens to us is not just important because we should not be harmed, and tolerating that kind of harm against any group of people creates a tolerance for that kind of inequity and injustice in general, but because that powerful anti-democratic ideology that allows us to do that supports the idea of injustice and hierarchy all around, right? Ruthie Gilmore, right? Ruthie Gilmore, who's an abolitionist and a great scholar, often says that capitalism requires inequality and racism enshrines it. So, what she's basically saying is that racism legitimates a kind of permanent hierarchy in the context of what's supposed to be a democratic state for the sake of helping capitalism to be able to reproduce itself. And that idea is powerfully anti-democratic idea. And I think that's something that we're contending with all the time. But Eric, the thing I'm interested in from you is that you are right now in the center of a struggle in the Northwest. And I just wonder, like, where do you see us winning? What do you see working now?
You know, you actually have to acknowledge you've won something to be able to acknowledge that something might be working, right? There's a level of, I don't even know what to call it, progressive pessimism. There's just like a level of pessimism right now where I often call our social movements now kind of like the Eeyores of social movements. And Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. If you haven't read Winnie the Pooh, you should check it out from the Multnomah Library. But there's a character named Eeyore who is a donkey who is ever sad and dejected about how nothing works out. It's I think it's because we can't hold nuance. And I'm going to come back to what I think is actually working, but I want to set the context. We've lost our ability to imagine. We have been so beaten up by the right in this country that we think it's weak to talk about dreams. We've become so intimidated by the authoritarians in this country, folks who oppose democracy, folks who want to promote racism and other forms of bigotry. We've become so intimidated that we're ashamed to say that at the end of the day, the world we're trying to create is one where people have more good days than bad days. It's actually not that complicated. That's what most of us around the world think about each day, right? I think we've lost our way. For those who understand that we still must push for the country we say that we want to be, for the communities we say we want to be. You know, a society, I think I often say, I quote an old friend of mine, right, where everyone can live, love, worship, and work free from fear and bigotry. We have to push for that world. That's the right thing to do. And we need to be urgent about it. We also have to be more humble about how far we've gone and how far people have brought us. There's a level of arrogance that rejects the fact, you know, that life in 2021, America, at least for Black people, mostly, is better than 1921. 2021 is a lot better than 1821. Now, I'm not trying to say like we're there, right? That we're sitting in the promised land. There's still too much inequality in this country. We have to acknowledge that people struggled to get us to the moment we are now. And we've learned one thing. And if you want to know what I think works, I think there's two things that work. The first is democracy. Black and indigenous people have struggled for democracy in this country for a very, very long time. Other folks as well, right? And I think we treat it in a way that suggests it's not of our own making, right? The real thing is, I think you taught me this in the 90s, democracy actually works when we practice democracy. Not vanguardism, not elitism, but actual democracy. That's the piece, I think it is the sunlight to authoritarianism in here. The second piece that no one wants to talk about is what I call racial intimacy or religious intimacy is actually critical too, right? And it is how we inoculate ourselves against authoritarianism in this moment. But those two things take being really brave and being really courageous and understanding that sometimes you sadly find yourself in a moment where you get the win. You're not fighting for the win. And here's the secret, and then, you know, we'll turn it over. What I think works is democratic practice and mobilizing people, lots of people, through different ways. We built coalitions in the 90s where you could see Republican farmers sitting next to blue-haired punk rockers. That's the coalitions we need again. We need real governance that practices democracy. And the third thing we need, it's going to sound like the weakest word in the world, but it's time to do away with segregation in the city of Portland, right? Segregation in housing, in employment, in education, transportation. It is killing democracy in Portland, Oregon. It is killing democracy in this country. And I'll just leave it with the words of an alt-right activist 4 years ago. I tell this story all the time. He was outside the Blues Festival in Portland, Oregon. He was being harangued by the counter-protester, yelling, "Why are you here? No one wants you here. Why are you here?" And this alt-right activist responded by saying, "Yeah, I've heard you don't want us here, but the truth is, Portland is shrinking. It has a shrinking Black population by a percentage and whole number." And then he said, "So you can say you don't want us here, but the fact of the matter is you all are doing something we could never get away with. You are disappearing the Black population of Portland, Oregon." The truth is this. The magic of that podcast and the magic of the 90s was that it taught us to look in the mirror. If we want to understand how we defeat white nationalism, we have to be courageous enough to understand that we don't beat it through our own political theater by somehow trying to out-physically outpower it. We beat it by building an alternative vision of what Portland and America can be. And that only happens through building the power of people so that they can come to a consensus. That's what works in the Pacific Northwest. And when we do that, white nationalists lose.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Selena Flores, Aaron Yankee, and Mike Crenshaw, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, PM Press, the Marla Davis Fund, KBOO Community Radio, and the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
By the mid-90s, I was somewhere else. This was had started in the 80s for me, so I was kind of the beginning, and then, you know, I kind of stepped out probably 92, 93. Someone had been murdered. I even moved to Eugene for a while to lay low because someone told me they came to kill me. The in bitch China. This is real stuff. I mean, I tell people that look at me like, really? But this is what was going on, you know? There was a point that I realized that nobody was listening to me. I realized at a point I need to go to college. So I went to college. I mean, it took me many years to graduate, but I was just like, I just realized I had to live.
That was China who started the first episode and also our last. Welcome to episode 14 of It Did Happen Here. I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores. At the height of the skinhead violence, many small groups in Portland presented a unified front made up of groups who embraced a diversity of tactics, stood in solidarity with each other, and respected each other's boundaries despite subcultural differences. Jonathan Mazzocchi contrasts that with today.
Last year, year before, I can't remember when, Trump singled out the Antifa for cops and soldiers and tough guys to attack. In the wake of his attack on anti-fascist forces, there was very little political support among the larger, more important leftist organizations, like Democratic Socialists of America, Bernie Sanders. They weren't out front defending Antifa. So what that told me is that anti-fascists today are relatively politically isolated, and that perhaps there was moment after Charlottesville, where Dr. Cornel West has said the Antifa saved his life. Maybe there was an opportunity to give some political support to the Antifa for the work that they were doing. But I think in large part it was missed. They're on the front lines. All of the United States and Europe and elsewhere, these local groups need, well, what do they need? They need platters of brownies. They need political protection. I don't see enough of that. I think there should be more.
How do we end a story that's on a continuum? We're at the end of our podcast. We tried to give a slice of history behind this pretty picture of Portland in the 21st century with our gentrified shops and new condos. What did we learn from the three groups who generously shared their stories? Bulaguetta Sarah taught us that no one is safe when white supremacists are unchecked. We can't ignore them, even if the police in the city deny that there is a problem.
From the Coalition for Human Dignity, we learned the role of queer people in bridging communities, the value of building and maintaining connection across different organizations, the importance of local research as a support for local activism, and ways to show up to protect citizens in allyship. We learned that training in self-defense is community defense, that owning political mistakes supports integrity and neglecting internal equity diminishes group longevity.
Anti-racist action taught us how we can build a national network against hate out of a group of friends. Also, how to stand up, come together, and turn the tide from reaction to direct action. From Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, or SHARP, we learn that to be bold is effective, but the price of living with violence and conflict can be higher than we can afford.
And from the long years since, we've learned that we need to expand our thinking, that immediate local solutions may appear to be effective while driving problems underground or to the suburbs. The hardest thing for many people to hear may be the following words urging activists to take care of ourselves and each other. Let's start with Eric Ward.
We live in a time in the United States where many Americans, not just vulnerable communities, are experiencing vast income inequality for the first time. I do not, as an African American who has grown up under vast income inequality, I do not wish that upon anyone. We understand the stresses that that brings. We know it leaves people vulnerable to other messages as they try to understand why they've been abandoned in this society. And that income inequality, that anxiety around demographic change, and the fact that we are right now debating what it means to be American is a perfect storm. In that storm, the white nationalist movement has brought its bigotry. It will continue to recruit members until we build enough infrastructure and movements to start competing for that same constituency. That is the next challenge for those who oppose authoritarianism and totalitarianism and who seek to create an inclusive America that's people-centered, transparent, and accountable. We aren't trying to start a race war. We're trying to end one.
I'm a mom, you know, I can't be there right now on the front lines and at my age and stuff. I mean, I've done that. So there are people that aren't there for various reasons, but there's supporters and people that see the truth about what's happening. I would say to the activists, keep your head, keep your values, but go take care of yourself. Go get a medical checkup, eat right, go to school. Not that Western education is the answer to everything, but having that piece of paper behind your name kind of gives validity to some of the stuff that you're saying. There's different activists. You know, I'd say if you're a white activist, keep up the fight. If you're a person of color, if you're Black, if you're disabled, if you're somebody that is in danger, I don't think you need to be up there on the front lines all the time. I mean, find other ways to do the work, but take care of yourself. We've been fighting this for a long time in America. I mean, I'm going to say 500 years. Take care of yourself. There's people watching you and they're taking heart, but ultimately, if you're not taking care of yourself, nobody's really going to care about you. But let some of these white kids, privileged white kids and white people that see what's wrong, stand up and do some of the fighting, because it really needs to be addressed by white people, people with privilege, white privilege. And you don't need to go to jail. We need you out. We need you to go to school. We need you to take care of yourself.
That was China. We're going to go out with Reverend Cecil Prescott, CHD activist and board member, who offers a reminder that to love others, we must love ourselves.
You know who you are and what the things that you are fighting for, the things you are struggling for. Maintain that focus. And also, you need time to relax and to breathe and to be able to build community and support one another, because it's hard work. We need to find ways to nurture, to be aware of one another, to be aware when someone's just looks as if they're tired, and to be able to spend time and to take care of one another. It's important to struggle, but also remember what we're struggling for, and we have to take care of ourselves so we can be here for the long haul.
After the podcast ended, we did a few public events. This is from an event hosted by Enrique Rivera and sponsored by the Multnomah County Library. We'll start with my co-host, Mike Crenshaw.
You know, I am often just blown away by there's a phrase, and I'll fill it up when I try to say it, but it's something like the result is greater than the sum of its whole or something. Y'all know what I'm talking about? We're able to do something together that none of us could have done alone. And it's a real testament to the power of community and lived history being recognized and respected, and a desire in the community to want to understand that the stories that are parts of people's lived experience can teach us. It's just such a powerful resource in a world where we're so encouraged to seek external resources, you know, to seek commodities and to buy things to make us more whole. The fact that we have a living history that's not part of the dominant narrative is I feel like it's an opportunity for us to pivot and to gain ground and to start to redirect, to continue in the process of redirecting things towards a more just world.
Mm-hmm. The whole of us is Mike and Selena and I, like, produced it and did a lot of stuff, but Mo Baustern and Icky A did help with the narration, which was so valuable and so crucial. We're just so in it. So we have this great mix of people who were adjacent, and Icky grew up in the scene here and lived it. No one knows what Pioneer Square is outside of Portland. And it was like, oh, got it. Okay, like, I see. There's so much that I take for granted in this story. And so they were really great at not being as deep in it. And then, of course, they got as deep in it as we did. And Julie Perini is our visual assets coordinator, is the modern term, but she was really great at digging through archives and finding the images. And then folks would then reach out to us and, like, give us posters and pictures. And that also was just so cool to get to see that stuff of, like, people have just kept this because it's meaningful. Then we get to give it a more of a public platform. So yeah, we really had a great dream team putting this podcast together.
Thank you. What would you like listeners to take away from the podcast?
I'm hoping that we find ways, that people find ways to get involved that they feel is really, like, where they need to be. I don't want people to be encouraged to do things that feel out of their there's not a lot of language for it. Like, we could say, I don't want to use the term comfort zone, because we're not trying to maintain a comfort zone. But I want people to feel empowered and encouraged and inspired to challenge what's happening in a way that's right for them.
Totally. I think that's great. A lot of people weren't here at the time, a lot of people were, you know, so it's just, I think it's really important to know the stories about where you live. Now, because of the 30th anniversary commemoration all around the neighborhood where Mulugeta was murdered, there's actually memorial things on top of the street signs. So there's a signal to people that they can like note it, and like if they don't know, like, oh, now they can find out, which I think is really awesome. This was a hard story to find out about if you don't know the people. One of the things I'm really excited about this podcast existing is like, now you don't actually have to know Mike or have to know these people and then know their history to be able to ask them questions. This is one thing that happened in a wave of things that happened. So what was happening, Enrique, you've got the Mexican Latino history in Oregon tab, you know, what was happening with the Native people in struggling for their rights. There's the whole thing with Emmanuel Hospital, like check that out. You know, there's a lot of things that we can do to learn more about where we live and how the dominant culture of people in power fuck over people who aren't in power. If we know more about all of those struggles in the past, we can prevent harm from happening currently and help heal from harm that happened in the past. It's up to us to know about this place that we live.
That was Aaron Yankee, executive producer of the podcast. And now we'll hear from my co-host, Selena Flores.
The idea of community and organizing in a broad sense, creating, like in the podcast, we hear about these different groups that come and work together. And I think that that is so important and is applicable to today.
What do you want people to take away from it, Enrique, as a listener?
As a listener? Well, I mean, it was a great story. I mean, you guys said it yourselves pretty well. But I think it is important for people to know the history of the place that they're currently occupying. I mean, that's part of the reason that we do a land acknowledgement at the beginning of our programs, is so that we pay respects to those who've come before us, whose lands we're on. Knowing the local history of the folks who live here, I mean, Portland's Oregon in itself is not a very diverse part of the country. And it's getting to be through the time and whatnot. And so there's a lot of history. There, you know, there's personally growing up, I experienced a lot of xenophobia. I came up about the tail end of, you know, when Nazism was big in Oregon. I didn't really see a lot of that. I remember there was some here and there, but by that scene had died out by the time I was coming of age. But there was still a lot of like racism structurally and stuff like that. So I think these programs and these podcasts are important so that people can know. I mean, if you haven't experienced it yourself, if you have empathy, you can feel through what's being expressed in these and hopefully learn from that.
I just wanted to address that first question that came up about how did ARA spread to different cities? In the beginning, you know, us in Minneapolis started the organization, the network of anti-racist action. It stemmed from the Baldies, which was an anti-racist skinhead crew that were actively engaged in confronting and fighting against the White Knights, our opposition. The White Knights were organized by the Ku Klux Klan. While we were doing that work, we got wind not only through commercial media, but through underground networks of communication like Maximum Rock and Roll, okay, that had scene reports where they would talk about different punk scenes in different cities. We got word that other cities were also facing Nazi problems. And so we reached out to the closest cities in our region. Me being from Chicago originally, I was going back and forth between Minneapolis and Chicago. And so I established relationships very intentionally with Black skinheads and anti-racist skinheads in a crew called Skinheads of Chicago. That first meeting we had in 86, 87, it's so hard for me to pinpoint the year, but we had over 100 anti-racist skinhead crews, primarily from the Midwest. And that was the impetus. That was the catalyst. And from there, it went on. And people would travel and start chapters, or people would find out through word of mouth or through some print literature, and they would start chapters in their own city.
To go into it a little more, we'll hear an excerpt from one of our bonus episodes, Cultural Organizing with Maximum Rock and Roll. This is Martin Sprouse, a graphic artist as well as a longtime associate of Maximum Rock and Roll.
So pre-internet, this sounds a little odd, but Maximum Rock and Roll was one of the largest international punk fanzines there was, and it was more newspaper-like. So we put a huge concern or focus on communication, printing other addresses, like we said, scene reports, letters, contacts, fanzine reviews, record label reviews. So there's always a lot of pen pal writing and phone calls going on. It was big, thick, and dishy on newsprint. We never went glossy because the idea was just to keep it as inexpensive as possible and get it around as much as possible.
Here's Mike again.
In these zines, these like black and white paper rags, there would be scene reports. And you started to see like, oh, these people are fucking having Nazi problems everywhere right now. You reach out to people in those scenes. We built the network that way, and that network came all the way out to Portland.
For people that don't know, the scene report in those early days of Maximum, again, pre-internet, is people from different cities, just kids, would just handwrite letters talking about what was going on in that actual city. And it could be from a big city like Chicago or a small town where there's only one or two bands. And we would always print them. And so what the scene reports would consist of mainly is talking about which bands come from there, if they have a demo tape out, if they have a record out, always including addresses, and then talk about local fanzines or anybody else that's doing good, record stores, promoters. So we'd get these in every day. We'd get, I don't know, a couple of them every day, and every issue would have, what, 10 to 15 scene reports from all over the world, not just the United States. And again, like the title says, just a scene report, exactly what was going on in that scene. You know, after internet, it's just so weird how explaining this stuff to people, how it worked, but it really was. And that was mainly what it was known for, is addresses, phone numbers.
When Martin describes the scene reports as what was going on in that scene, you might wonder why people wanted to know. Punk culture is highly migratory. Bands, of course, went on tour, but it was pretty normal for other people to get in the van and go along, drop their life, and travel with others or alone. They rode the Greyhound, hitchhiked, hopped freight trains, or got drive-away cars. Knowing anything about a town before you got there, like where to get free pizza from friendly local punks, or what squat was safe to sleep in, was valuable information, kind of like an open-source Yelp. For the punks, connection was the wealth we all built together. The network was woven into our lives at the time, along with a great deal of trust and varying overlapping degrees of privilege. That network made it easier to spread the word about everything, including how to fight racist boneheads.
San Francisco always had skinheads, but they're more like street skins. And then Nazi skins started coming in and infiltrating again. We had the American Front, and Bob Hike was part of that. That all came out of San Francisco, which people don't realize. This was before he hooked up with Tom Metzger. Tim Yohannan, who was one of the main people from Max Marco, and a couple of the other people, wanted to open up a club. So the idea is that I would come up there and help work on the magazine while these other people started trying to open up a club. Ultimately, Gilman Street was a byproduct of that move.
Gilman Street is an all-ages, volunteer-run, nonprofit, pro-kid, collectively-run music and social club located in a warehouse at 924 Gilman in Berkeley, California. In the mid-80s, there were few public music spaces that could be accessed by people under 21. The founders saw a need for a space where punk kids could have and play shows without getting busted by the cops or ripped off by promoters. Gilman's ethos was grounded in all-ages collective organizing, where the audience had as much responsibility as the bands and the workers to make the show and the scene what they wanted it to be.
When we opened Gilman in 86, some of our first confrontation were skinheads coming over from the city that were kind of street skins, that wanted to beat everybody up. And, you know, anytime there was a fight at Gilman, we would immediately break it up, the bands would stop, everything would stop, and those guys would get thrown out. And we also had this policy, of course, we wouldn't let any Nazi skinheads in Gilman. So a lot of times there was huge confrontations at the door. But as Gilman went on, Nazi skinheads started coming a bit more to Gilman. And these were the white boys from the suburbs, not so much from San Francisco. You know, Screwdriver shirts and all that fish.
Screwdriver was a Northern English punk band with working class Oi roots who embraced white nationalism in the early 80s. They were at one time the most notorious white power skinhead punk band in the world. To wear one of the band's t-shirts is to declare an allegiance to white supremacy.
We didn't let those guys ever come in, so we just had huge confrontations. there were definitely a lot of fights. We always won because they never got in there. The shows wouldn't go on with anyone fighting or doing any bullshit. They decided if we caught somebody that snuck in with a screwdriver shirt, say they had it underneath their jacket, they would get thrown out right away too. That was one way of dealing with it. It was successful, but ultimately it didn't get rid of the skinheads. And after about 2 years, a second group of people kind of took over the organizing of it. And they were a lot more lax than we were. And that was pretty bad. Then the third generation of people that came in, they actually had security dudes from the punk scene that just went and beat the shit out of the skinheads. And that really did take care of it. There were no more skinhead problems.
Now back to the Multnomah County Library event recorded in March 2021. This is Enrique Rivera, our host.
We've got another question. What has this work taught you about yourself? Any insights you've encountered as you engaged in these conversations? And then they express that this is a purposely broad question.
For me, I think this is the largest project that I've ever been involved in. So as the tentacles reached out to all the, you know, more and more places, like, I've learned a lot about organization and how you actually pull something like this off. Most of the podcasts you hear, like at the end of it, they're like, and thanks to our 5 editors and thanks to our 4 producers and our 17 reporters and blah, 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 blah. And there was really not that many of us doing this work. So I really learned a lot about the behind the scenes stuff. And with regards to the content, it's definitely made me much more vocal about that there is a place for everybody in this fight and that we have to be really engaged in it.
Living this life has forced me to acknowledge that I have a lot of PTSD. There's aspects of that that I wish I didn't have to face, because it's not like something that sits in a neatly arranged package that you pull out when you choose to. It's something that comes up when it decides to come up. That's the shadow side, I think, internally. You know, the light side of that education is that I became situationally aware. And that leads into the concern about, you know, how do you feel? How safe do you feel? The being involved in what I was involved in taught me how to feel safe wherever I go. Even in danger, it's almost as if I feel, when I'm forced to stand my ground, I feel more at home in that situation than a lot of people who haven't been through some of these things. The challenge with all of that is that I exist in a Black body, and that Black bodies have always been vulnerable to racial terror and hypercriminalization and stereotypes and tropes that actually get us killed. And so me standing my ground is different. It's easier for me to lose my life standing my ground than it is for some other people.
For me, it taught me that I love this work. I hadn't ever done anything like this before that was so collaborative and also so engaging with other people. Well, I guess that's not entirely true because I take photos of people, but in a different way. And just the synergy of all the elements coming together to create something, as Mike said, greater than the sum of its parts. Yeah, if this could be like a career going forward, that would be amazing. I love this. Some of the insights I've gained are just kind of like the piece about finding my place in this struggle or battle. Because I've questioned that a lot. I feel like I'm a little closer to having that insight into myself.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Selena Flores, Aaron Yankee, and Mike Crenshaw. And your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Mike, Selena, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KBOO Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
We're told that after the war, the Nazis vanished without a trace. But battalions of fascists still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. The prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Whilst heads remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialize. So why did they all come out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. If you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's